Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about evangelicalism, the second part of our conversation with Dr. Daryl Hart. Part of the task of Issues Etc. is to purposely swim against the tide, against the current of American evangelicalism. So much of what is presented there is a watered-down version of historic Christianity. It's acreedal, it's ahistorical, it's asacramental. And worst of all, as a result of all of those, it is often a-Christocentric. That is, Christ no longer occupies the center of the theology. Something else, someone else does, maybe even that sovereign individual. Now, in doing that, we ask for your support, of course, and we have a new means of support for Issues Etc. It's called our Reformation Club. It's a monthly giving operation. There are three levels, that of the confessor for $25 a month or an annual gift of $250. You will receive as a token of our thanks as you support Issues Etc., an Issues Etc. journal subscription, an Issues Etc. tape of the month, and the book from Craig Parton, The Defense Never Rests, wherein he deals with many of the issues we're talking about in this very hour. At the level of the apologist, for $50 a month or $500 per year, you'll get all the benefits of being a confessor and a quarterly Issues Etc. book of the month, that is four books per year. At the level of the reformer, $100 per month or an annual gift of $1,000, all of the confessor and apologist benefits, three Issues Etc. journal subscriptions, two Issues Etc. tapes of the month. You can give one away. Oh, give those subscriptions away, too. A written transcript of each Issues Etc. tape of the month and an Issues Etc. book of the month for all 12 months of the year. If you'd like to become an Issues Etc. a confessor, apologist, or reformer, call our resource line 1-800-737-0172 or visit our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. You can also write us. Our address, Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. That's Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. If you'd like to join our conversation, as we talk about evangelicalism with Dr. Daryl Hart, Academic Director of Academic Projects and Faculty Development at the Intercollegiate Studies Institute in Wilmington, Delaware, and author of the book, Deconstructing Evangelicalism, Conservative Protestantism in the Age of Billy Graham, feel free to give us a call, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I especially want to hear from those of you who have come out of American evangelicalism. I'd like to know why. Hank is up first, calling from Maplewood. Hank, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hello.
Hi.
I take great exception to what you're saying here. I consider myself an evangelical. And I believe you've set up a straw dog here to destroy, which really bears no relationship to what evangelicalism really is. Billy Graham is a evangelical preacher who does not in himself embody evangelicalism, and the core of evangelicalism, I would say, are the beliefs in certain fundamentals, namely the inerrancy of Scripture, the divinity of Christ, the sufficiency of his work on the cross for salvation, the absolute fact that salvation is a gift through faith, not earned by works, and that the resurrection, the virgin birth, etc. These are the core issues of Christianity, derived from a belief in the truth of the Scriptures, that they're absolutely true, and this is what evangelicalism is. And in fact, I believe that Christianity is a matter of those who accept it, who receive and believe the words of Christ, which come to us in the Bible. And this is what evangelicalism is. Those who have received these words, received Christ through his word, and apply the whole word of God, since they have received Christ and the promise of salvation, to all the issues of life. And so you have extraneous manifestations, such as political ones of evangelicalism, which are, of course, preaching the gospel is the core and essence of evangelicalism, but, and of course, preaching against abortion is one work of the church. And I disagree with your view of the church, which is a very Catholic one, I believe, that it is a very concrete organization, human organization, with an office on Lindbergh, I believe. And, you know, the church is all those who subscribe to the words of Christ.
Hank, there's nothing in what you have said there that I can find myself disagreeing with. We got to deal with what you've laid on the table before us as well. Let me say, just for myself, I consider myself an evangelical, one of the original type of evangelicals. That's what Lutherans first called themselves, Evangelisch, people of the gospel, because that was the heart and center, the beating heart and center of the Reformation. Now, I'm using the term evangelical there in a different sense than most evangelicals use it, and I detect in our caller that he is also using the term evangelical in a far different sense than most evangelicals would use it. Am I right there, Daryl?
I think that's right, although, I mean, when I think it was Hank, was that his name?
Yes.
Started to talk about the church. I mean, it does raise interesting questions, and one of the things that I would ask him is, how does he know then who is an evangelical or not? And he's likely going to ask questions of certain people claiming to be evangelical, ask them questions about all those very things that he affirmed, which I would also want to affirm myself, although I'd like to affirm more than that, and I'll try to get to that. But so he is in effect doing in analyzing someone's responses to his questions about what they mean evangelical to be, he's doing precisely what churches do when they admit people into the faith. But who, I mean, I don't mean to be flip about this, but who gave him that responsibility? It does seem to me that one of the things that the Bible, the inerrant Bible, teaches is the importance of church officers. That's partly what the pastoral epistles are about. And this is one of my reservations also about evangelicalism. One of evangelicalism's key verses is the Great Commission. Having grown up an evangelical, I know that. But one of the interesting things about the Great Commission is that Christ told the apostles to teach everything he had commanded, not simply about his deity, not simply about his atonement, but also about the importance of church officers, which is what Paul is teaching Timothy and Titus about.
No,
so you know, this notion that we somehow want to reduce the faith to core doctrines is, I clearly can understand why that might be valuable, but it's oftentimes for forming coalitions that then transcend the work of the church. And it does seem to me that, I understand that American Protestants have a long history of thinking that any kind of affirmation about the importance of the visible church, it sounds like Rome, but if you look at the reformers of the 16th and 17th centuries, they were talking about the church in ways not that different from Roman Catholics, even though they had a very different understanding of their relationship to the Bishop of Rome and the various ways in which the church government needed to be reformed and instituted. But I still think that you can make a case from the inerrant Word of God about the importance of the ministry of the visible church and of church officers.
But Jesus, the church, the one holy Christian church, certainly does exist invisibly. I would say hidden rather than invisible.
Right.
Hidden from our perception. It is an article of faith. That is why it is an article of the creed. But it seems to me that one of the faults of evangelicalism is that while it so strongly affirms the invisible church, it is unwilling to recognize the church as Christ has instituted it through things that can actually be seen and heard, like the pure preaching of the gospel and the right administration of the sacraments.
And ironically, then, what has often happened, and I've seen it again having grown up in it, but also having studied evangelicalism, is that other things then are added onto what counts for being a true Christian. And one of the stories I often tell is my utter shock and horror when my athletic hero as a young boy, Richie Allen, the third baseman for the Philadelphia Phillies, and I was under the impression that all my heroes should be Christians, so therefore I attributed to him the virtue of being a Christian. Well, one day they panned down the dugout, and they showed him smoking, and I knew that Christians couldn't smoke. So there are other visible things that are attached to being a Christian by evangelicalism. So even though you want to affirm the invisible nature of the church, oftentimes other visible things immediately come to bear, and it's partly because we are people in bodies and therefore have to make certain things visible. But you're precisely right that there are means that God has ordained that typically evangelicalism, unfortunately, has not affirmed as being important to Christian affirmation as they or Christian identity as they should.
And by the way, just inside to the caller before, to Hank, the building down on Kirkwood Road is no more church than the grocery store across the street from it. It is a bureaucratic headquarters of congregations. So just to clarify that, lest I be misunderstood to agree with what he accused me of saying. Is there life for evangelicalism after Billy Graham? Who is the heir apparent in this role of kind of religious celebrity par excellence?
Well, if you look at the way Billy has tried to hand on his own organization to Franklin, it shows how difficult it is to hand over celebrity to a junior, to a son. Celebrity is oftentimes cultivated not by familial things, but often by marketing, various other circumstances that just happen in one's life. The other people, I think, who are vying in some ways for the center of evangelicalism, you could think of James Dobson with Focus on the Family, or Tim LaHaye with his novels, incredibly successful. But these men are also older and probably going to retire soon. So then can someone like a Rick Warren do it? And his book, Purpose-Driven Church and Now Purpose-Driven Life, have been incredibly successful. But interestingly, he is also a minister in a local Southern Baptist congregation, and therefore there are certain restraints on him going big time that aren't there for these parachurch.
But he has found a way of multiplying his presence through the 40 days of purpose thing, wherein via satellite or via videotape, he is preaching in a lot of churches across the nation on a Sunday by Sunday basis during those 40 days.
Right, and it's been a phenomenal marketing effort, and I've read some of the reports or journalism on it that Zondervan has done very well. So you're right, and the question probably for him at some point will be whether some of his aides and advisors are saying, look, you can take this perhaps to another level by leaving the duties of your local church. I have no idea if that's going on, but so he could conceivably be someone, but then I don't get cable TV anymore, so I don't see who some of the prominent evangelicals are there. Chuck Swindoll, Charles Stanley also come to mind as being important spokesmen, but, I mean, Billy did something that no one else did, and again, a lot of it had to do with just some things that he himself couldn't have even planned for throughout the course of his career. And again, it seems to be very difficult to hand all that momentum and the stuff of celebrity over to someone else. So I think probably what will happen is that the Billy Graham Association, Evangelical Association, will become more organizational and less associated with one person. But, that's just a hunch.
Dr. Daryl Hart is our guest, author of the new book, Deconstructing Evangelicalism, Conservative Protestantism in the Age of Billy Graham. We're talking about evangelicalism. Back to the phones at 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Calling from his car, Bill is on the line. Bill, welcome.
Oh, thank you. I'd like to ask your guest if he knows how much Billy Graham and his association has been influenced by Charles Finney.
By Charles Finney?
Yes. Give us a brief bio of Finney and his teachings, and then answer Bill's question, if you would.
Uh, Well, Charles Finney was a prominent revivalist in the so-called Second Great Awakening. His dates are roughly 1800 to 1875. And he is probably best known for his so-called New Measures, which were where he supposedly departed from the awakenings of the 18th century, was in saying that you could actually predict when revivals would take place if you did certain things, if you conducted the meetings in certain ways. And so he had a number of techniques that he used to generate a response from his audience to bring them up to a point of a conversion experience. I guess probably to answer then the question about the effects of or the influence of Finney on Graham, I would say it's probably not direct, but I think it's likely very much in the air. You can see a succession of revivalists from Finney down to Moody, Dwight L. Moody down to Billy Sunday, and then on down to Graham. It's not as if there was a school somewhere that these guys were going to studying the same textbooks or anything. I think it was very much in the air of American society and American Protestant religion, as far as this is the way that you reach autonomous individuals. You get them to make a decision for Christ. You appeal to them as individuals, and you try to take the gospel to the people and let them decide. And oftentimes, having the church in the way, having ministers in the way of doing that, actually prevents the spread of the gospel more so than revivalists just taking it out to big stages, out into the countryside, tent meetings or whatever. And so I think it's just something that Billy Graham himself grew up with, and part of what he appealed to.
So where did Finney's teachings go wrong, very briefly?
I think he gave way too much credit for humans in their ability to choose Christ, and didn't recognize sufficiently the necessity of the work of the Holy Spirit in that conversion process. But also, by trying to make revivalism a science, he in effect baptized certain manipulative techniques, and again took the Holy Spirit out of the process, so that if you did things a certain way, you could almost mechanically ensure that you would generate a revival. And historic Protestantism, both Lutheran and Reformed, has always emphasized that the work of the church, the work of word and sacrament, needs to be accompanied by the work of the Holy Spirit and also the faith of the believer.
Do you see the remnants of Finney in the average Sunday morning worship service nowadays in the evangelical church, with its emotionalism, its experientialism, what you call luxuriant self-concern?
Yes and no. I mean, I think you can actually trace it all the way back, some of that luxuriant self-concern, to the awakenings of the 18th century and my limited exposure to Pietism in the 17th century and some of the more radical forms of Puritanism in England in the 17th century as well, that the movement, it seems to me there's a fundamental dynamic in modern Christianity, especially the Protestant wing, and that is that the more you move away from the church, the more you move to the subjectivity of the self, and conversely, the more you move away from the self, the more you move toward the objectivity of the ministry of the church. And in America, once you have the disestablishment of religion and you no longer have the backing of the government supporting the church, you have a free-for-all that allows the subjective to triumph in ways unplanned and unpredicted over the institutional church.
So what's wrong with confessional church bodies, historically confessional church bodies, like yours, the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, mine, the Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod, becoming more and more like a modern American evangelicalism?
What's wrong with it is that it's at odds with their confessional standards, their books of church order, their liturgies. I mean, it's you can't. I don't think it's possible to, at least in my own case, to continue to affirm the Westminster Confession and Catechisms, and our Directory of Public Worship and our Book of Church Order, while at the same time embodying the faith the way that evangelicals do. There's overlap, to be sure. Now, I don't want to make it seem as if evangelicalism is antithetical to historic Protestantism, whether Lutheran or Reformed. There's clearly a realm of overlap between the two. And the one caller earlier, I think, affirmed where some of that overlap would be. But when you make the individual sovereign, you really do undermine the ministry of the church. And I hate to sound like a broken record on that, but it does seem to me that that is one of the missing dimensions of American Protestantism, which is the ministry of the church, as well as the study of American Protestantism by scholars. And that's part of the reason for writing the book.
With only 30 seconds here, Daryl, what is the lesson that American evangelicalism has not yet learned?
I think I put it in terms of what I already affirmed earlier, which is taking the Great Commission seriously. And what is it that Christ's people are to go out and to teach the whole world, to teach them everything that he has commanded? How are they to disciple the nations? They're to do that by teaching everything he's commanded and baptizing them. And it seems to me the Great Commission is a wonderful affirmation of the importance of word and sacrament. So as much as evangelicals, and I think rightly, emphasize the Great Commission, they need to think that Great Commission through more and connect the dots between it and the ministry of the church.
Dr. Daryl Hart, thank you very much for the book. I enjoyed it immensely, and thank you for being our guest.
Well, thanks. It was great to be with you, Todd.
Dr. Daryl Hart, Academic Director of Academic Projects and Faculty Development at the Intercollegiate Studies Institute in Wilmington, Delaware. He's authored this book, Deconstructing Evangelicalism, Conservative Protestantism in the Age of Billy Graham. He's got a great little recipe for evangelicalism near the end of his book. I have to read it for you. The recipe for evangelicalism: combine 2 cups of inerrancy, 1 cup of conversion, a pinch of doctrinal affirmations, just a pinch. Form into a patchwork of parachurch agencies, religious celebrities, and churches, season with peppy music, professionally performed, and bake every generation. It would probably do all of us evangelicals. I call myself evangelical with my own, well, it's not my own unique, it's just the original definition of the thing. But all evangelicals, all those who consider themselves to be people of the gospel, people for whom the beating heart and center of their theology, of their world, is the perfect life, the death, and the resurrection of Jesus Christ, and everything that he has taught, and the church that he has left instituted in the preaching of his word and the administration of the sacraments. It would do us all well to reflect upon our history and to ask ourselves, are we walking in the footsteps of the church before us, or have we deviated from the path to become something not church, but merely parachurch? When we come back, we'll be talking with John Shimkus.
A voice in the wilderness of American evangelicalism. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
In 1521, at the Diet of Worms, Martin Luther was asked to recant his writings. Luther responded, "Unless I am convinced from the sacred scriptures that I am in error, I cannot and will not recant. Here I stand. I cannot do otherwise. God help me." Will you stand with us as we proclaim these Reformation truths into the 21st century? You can take your stand by becoming a monthly contributor to Issues, Etc. To find out how you can become a confessor, an apologist, or a reformer, check out page 8 of the latest Issues Etc. journal, or visit our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. Help us proclaim the solas of the Reformation: grace, faith, scripture, for the sake of Christ alone. Here we stand, Issues Etc. and you.
A Stone Age flute. What's so remarkable?
Answers with Ken Ham, author of the powerful book, One Blood, The Biblical Answer to Racism. Well, can evolutionists draw a picture for us that our ancestors were primitive cavemen with low intelligence and used stone tools? Now, do you believe in cavemen? And if so, what sort of people were they?
Well, yes, I do believe in cavemen, but my definition is very simple. Cavemen are just men who live in caves. You know, sadly, many people have the idea that if someone lived in a cave or used stone tools, they must have been primitive. But the Bible helps us understand who cavemen were. After the Tower of Babel, different groups of people would have traveled in different directions over the earth. There would have been an immediate loss of culture and technology. Until they found suitable materials, some would have used stone tools and perhaps lived in caves. But this does not mean they lost any of their intelligence or their human characteristics. In a cave in Portugal, scientists found what looked like a flute made of bone. Now, this puzzled the evolutionists because they'd never think that these primitive, grunting stone ages had musical instruments. Should we be surprised, though, to find such an ancient flute? Adam's descendants built musical instruments because humans have always been intelligent. You see, we didn't evolve.
Since the Bible explains cavemen, would it also have anything to share about dinosaurs? Well, Ken Ham has written a booklet, What Really Happened to the Dinosaurs? And it should answer many of your questions. It's available free at AnswersRadio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. There is much to be concerned about when we consider how the immoral content of TV influences our children. But have you considered the influence of TV even apart from its content? Some sociologists are saying the primary danger of television lies not only in the behavior it produces, but also in the behavior it prevents. The talks, the games, the family festivities, and arguments through which much of the child's learning takes place and through which his character is formed. John 10, verse 10, Jesus says, I have come that they might have life and have it abundantly. Teach your children that the abundant life they have in Jesus is drastically shortchanged when they spend too much time watching TV. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at www.cmli.org.
In Nehemiah chapter 4, Nehemiah seemed to contend with enemies from without. In Nehemiah chapter 5, he contends with opponents from within. We'll talk about Nehemiah chapter 5 next time on our Bible study program with Pastor Kurt Taylor of St. John's Lutheran Church in Waltz, Michigan. Next time on the Bible study, heard weekday mornings at 10:05.
The Bible study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Last half hour, John Shimkus, representative of the 19th Congressional District in Illinois, joins us here for the first few minutes of this last half hour, and we'll be taking your questions and your comments here on the whole issue of the Super Bowl last night. Now, I asked you before, who to complain to? Who do you want to register your opinion with? Here's somebody you could register your opinion with. We might have time to take a few phone calls for Congressman Shimkus. But then, of course, after we've concluded our conversation with him, the last 15 minutes of the program are all for you. We can continue our conversation then, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Congressman John Shimkus, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hi, Todd. Great to be with you.
Good to hear from you again. Let's begin with last night's Super Bowl halftime show. Your general reaction?
Well, I'm aghast. I did watch the Super Bowl, but I've always turned off the Super Bowl during halftime. I've never been impressed with the shows. I've always thought they've been bad. And so all I know is what I hear. I don't watch a lot of TV, and the timing is amazing because we had our hearings from the FCC just last week. We dropped legislation to tenfold the fines for indecency over the airways. It was a piece of legislation that was going to move pretty quick before the Super Bowl, and I think that what happened yesterday will now add some jet fuel to the legislation. The public is just fed up with the FCC and its inability to police the airways.
So the bill here would add a zero to all the fines that the FCC can levy. Is that correct?
That's correct. Pretty much. Right now, per incident, it's supposed to be $27,500. it would raise that to $275,000, and there's a $3 million cap per whatever cycle, and it's just because when you're talking about major multi-corporations now, that's not even the current fines aren't enough to get anybody's attention. And the other problem is the SEC doesn't rule. I mean, it doesn't require the individual who's accused to prove their innocence. That you have to prove their guilt. So you have to be monitoring and taping and doing all this stuff. So what we're trying to do is get the SEC more empowered to do their function, which is police the public airwaves.
Well, very recently, the FCC proposed a $755,000 indecency fine against Clear Channel, that owns quite a number of radio stations here in St. Louis, over something that they allowed broadcast in another state. And that is the largest fine ever levied, and it's by far the largest fine ever levied. Is this the power that the FCC has over broadcasters?
Well, and with our legislation, they're going to be able to do more. Clear Channel is a multi-billion-dollar corporation, and their fine of $750 or whatever that was is still only a slap in the wrist. And if you read the text of the broadcaster who's from Tampa, Florida, he ought to be off the air. And Chairman Upton, my friend from Michigan, who chairs the subcommittee I sit on, you know, there's also talk about a three strikes you're out provision. After fines, you know, don't allow these folks access to the public airways if they can. And if it's in, the other thing is intent. Now I know the Super Bowl is going to be debated because you hear the apologists already saying, "Oh, it was an accident, it was a mistake." But from my conversation with people who observed the show, very indecent, very exploitive. And I think the intent was to be obscene, and that should be highly penalized.
Also, you all were a signatory to a one of two letters that was sent to Michael Powell at the FCC recently after the FCC ruled in the incident of an award show where the F word was used several times. The FCC said since it was used as an adjective and not a verb, that was essentially their reasoning, there was no reason to say that they violated the indecency code. What was the intent of the letter that was sent to the FCC then?
Well, to do exactly what they better do in the Super Bowl and what we drop legislation, that they need to police the airways. They don't need to make excuses for people that intentionally cloud up the public airways with pornographic and indecent material. And clear intent to shock, clear intent to degrade. The FCC is part of the administration. They're appointed by the president. The role of the administration is to enforce the laws that are signed by him and passed by us. We're saying they're not enforcing the law and they're not doing their job, and that's the intent of the letter.
Let's go to the phones here at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Larry's calling from Collinsville. Larry, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you. My question is also, what about cable television? There is just garbage on there. I was listening to C-SPAN one day, and a panel used the F-word about four times. And by the way, I don't even know what happened on the show the halftime. What can you give me an idea what happened?
Yeah, I'll give you idea, and then we'll get the answer from Congressman Shimkus to your question, Larry. Justin Timberlake and Janet Jackson were performing a musical number together. It involves some dancing, some rather lewd lyrics, but then, as kind of the grand finale of this, Justin apparently tore off the left breast of Janet Jackson's costume, exposing her, and then CBS went to a commercial real fast. But yet it's all over the news today, of course. Your response to his question about cable television, does the FCC regulate also broadcast cable television?
No, they don't. The legislation as is today is a debate over the public airways. So if it's a over-the-airways broadcast that then is picked up by cable, then the answer is yes. I think that the FCC can rule because of the over-the-airway ability. Cable, there is not the ability, based upon current law, to regulate it.
Is there no regulatory agency that oversees what is the content of cable?
Right. The difference is that cable is not free over the air, and you're not using the public airwaves. The corporate entities own the broadcast studios, they own the lines, and the person pays for that service. And where broadcast, whether it be TV or whether it be radio, that's free over the air, and we do have jurisdiction because, in essence, the federal government controls the airwaves.
We're going to be wrapping up this conversation with Congressman John Shimkus in about 5 minutes, and we'll take your phone calls at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727 for the rest of the hour. Now, if you want to discuss last night's Super Bowl halftime show, call now, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Congressman Shimkus, someone's going to say, look, we understand that we don't want our kids watching what happened on the Super Bowl last night during the primetime hour, but I fear government censorship. If they can censor this or things like it, then they can also censor other ideas as well. How do you respond to that?
Well, that's interesting, because I was going to do another talk show host in the locality, and he was pretty upset with my position on the airways just last week. But after the Super Bowl, he has now become a believer that we ought to do a better job policing the airways, especially in, like, as you mentioned, the family hour and the like. So, when we're legislators, you know, we have to look at what we perceive would be the public good. And we pass laws that should empower the country to move together as united as possible and look after the common welfare and the common good. So I feel very comfortable with saying, especially when you've got pornographic material, that should not be on the public airways and accessible to the youth of America, because that's a detriment to the public good.
And on the issue of Michael Powell, can we expect him to continue? Is the president going to – do you expect the president to perhaps reconsider Michael Powell as chairman of the FCC?
Actually, Michael Powell – the FCC is he's the chairman, but there's five members, and they're a diverse group of individuals. Michael Powell actually asked us to move the legislation that I support, that I'm a co-sponsor of, that increases the fines tenfold. He is a supporter of that, and has encouraged us to do that. So on this fight, I think we got a friend in Michael Powell. It's some of the other commissioners, and, you know, 3-2 vote, 4-1 vote, whatever, that the president ought to look at. But they can serve out their term, and they can't be fired until their term expires.
But after that point, the president can basically refuse to reinstate them.
Well, that's true. And part of the problem we've had, in fact, one of the FCC commissioners was leveraged, the Democratic member on the commission was leveraged by Tom Daschle to get his guy appointed to the FCC, and he allowed the release of some of the judicial, the judgeships debate. So it's not just always, there's a lot of negotiations that go on for some of these spots, and the president can't always get, you know, 100% of his standard in these appointments if he wants to get strong conservative judges on the bench.
Finally, Congressman Shimkus, I know you're a father of children. You have a family in Collinsville. Give us your father's reaction, the fatherly reaction, to what was on the airwaves last night, and the father's reaction to what you as lawmakers and our country ought to be doing in reaction to it.
Well, again, I'm just thankful that I was smart enough to change the channel during the halftime show. However, it has affected my children, because it was all the talk for kids. whose parents weren't as lucky to do that. And so now we'll have to deal with that, and teachers. I mean, it's just outrageous. But from a public policy person, and because of the legislation, as I've said before, I think it just is throwing gasoline on the fire, and that probably will help us move legislation expeditiously and maybe even stronger, with stronger powers, to allow the FCC to clearly start policing up the public airways.
Congressman John Shimkus, thank you for your time, and thanks for your hard work.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Congressman John Shimkus of the 19th Congressional District in Illinois, talking about last night's Super Bowl halftime show. All right, we've got 10 minutes left for your questions, your comments on last night's Super Bowl halftime show. Our phone lines are open now, 1-800-730-2727 or 505-7850. That's 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Reflecting on this earlier today, I was wondering, when we talk about the FCC, we are talking about a regulatory agency. It's under the big umbrella that is called the executive branch. It's under the president's administration. And under the president's administration, we've got all sorts of regulatory agencies like the EPA and all sorts of things. Generally speaking, I would say just generally speaking, social conservatives, political conservatives are very wary of this proliferation of governmental power through unelected, appointed governmental regulatory agencies. The move toward deregulation. Do you remember that? Oh, it still happens. Deregulation. Generally something that social and political conservatives will jump on right away and say, yes, we need to deregulate. Now, when you write your congressman or you write to one of the advertisers at a Viacom and you say, I am going to see to it, if my vote counts, I'm going to see to it that you have big fat fines levied against you. Let's be honest, folks. You are calling for those regulatory agencies to exercise the power of the pocketbook. And the legislation that says the fine used to be $27,500, it's now going to be $275,000. We're going to tack another zero on those things so they can really hurt these big international corporations. Who knows? You're right. Maybe through the fines, with fines like that, the FCC might be able to fund itself. You might get a tax cut out of this. We're up in arms if the EPA or some other environmental agency, regulatory agency, says we're going to fine this company or that company or this state and that state. Kind of shows the messy world we live in, doesn't it? The government's the problem until we want it to be the solution. Melanie's calling from her car. Melanie, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi. You know, I didn't watch the Super Bowl until the last few minutes of the game, which were the exciting part, and I'm really glad. I have a 9-year-old and 11-year-old daughters, and we homeschool, and we're not exposed to a lot of that stuff, and it's shocking to me. One thing that bothers me, though, is when we watch regular TV shows, you know, it could be a football game on Sunday afternoon or a kids program that's on. The program might be okay, but then they have commercials advertising shows that I would never let my children watch and that we don't watch either. You know, what can we do about that? Is the FCC looking at that too?
TiVo, that's the answer, I think. You know what TiVo is, don't you?
Oh, is that the automatic thing where you record what you want?
It'll record it for you, and there are no commercials. You can just say, TiVo, take out the commercials, and TiVo says, yes, master, and takes out your commercials for you. Or you know what my wife and I do? And we do this because of our time structure and not because we're particularly worried about commercials, although we probably should be a little more worried. Because of the kind of hours I work and the way it gels with the kids' bedtimes and stuff like that, we generally tape everything we watch, in the evening. We just close up the little entertainment center and tape everything that we want to watch. And then when we get to the commercials, whether the kids are watching now, and we've got a daughter now who stays up and watches with us often, we spin right through them. And at 500 frames per second, the commercials are hard to catch all the stuff. So you can spin through a lot of that, Melanie. There are ways around it, of course. I mean, from what I've heard, TiVo can give you commercial-free television if you're willing to wait. In fact, if you just wait a few minutes, start the old TiVo, wait a few minutes, start up it will play it for you. If you just watch 5 minutes later than the show comes on, it'll play it for you without commercials. Feeding it to you 5 minutes at a time, no problem. Or at your leisure. I bet you the advertisers, that's why you see no commercials for TiVo. Like, we're not going to advertise this thing. You're crazy. Of course, it does cost money. Derek is calling from his car. Derek, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Pastor, one of the families from our church hosted a Super Bowl party for everyone in the congregation last night. And I know of at least one other congregation in the area that did the same thing. I'm just wondering whether they're going to be brave enough to do it again next year.
Oh, my goodness. I hadn't even thought about that one. Oh, my goodness. Derek, thank you so much. Well, look, there's nothing wrong with the Super Bowl party. But it does strike one's funny bone to consider. I mean, yes, okay, go ahead. Think less of me. I don't care. People already think so little of me already. It does strike one's funny bone to say, come to our Christian. It's not going to be like your typical Super Bowl party where by the time half the show is over, the men are all wandering around in the backyard looking for their car keys or something like that. Christian Super Bowl party. Oh, boy. And it's going to be family-friendly. The kids, oh boy. You can hardly do that, actually. I wonder if these seeker-sensitive churches who hosted a Super Bowl party, you know, that's part of the way of reaching out with the gospel. Got reached out and touched by something else last night. I wonder if they used Janet Jackson's exposure as an opportunity to share the gospel after last night's halftime program. They sure as heck better have, because otherwise they wasted an opportunity. Ann's calling from Crestwood. Hi, Ann.
Hi, Ted. I'm a talk radio junkie, so I was bouncing between a couple stations today that are kind of news stations, and a lot of men were calling that were appalled at this, especially one guy who was 30 said he was watching with his 25 or 26-year-old brother, and he kept going on and on about how, why are they putting this in our face? Why is this in our face all the time? And so I was, and these were not Christian stations by any stretch, quite the opposite. And so I just encouraged all the men that were opposed to this, and I heard not one person call in that thought this was great and really enjoyed it. Mostly people are just totally fed up. And with all that talk today, I just kind of feel like maybe something's going to be done now.
And thank you. I was perusing the broadcast airwaves this morning as well, and I did hear several callers to talk radio programs here in the St. Louis area. I don't think any nationally. One young lady, in fact, called in just like, well, you know, I think we're just hung up on the human body. I think we Americans are just hung up on the human body. And I'm thinking to myself, I am about as, I mean, I'm politically conservative, not conservative enough for some, religiously very conservative, too conservative for most. And I'm thinking to myself, I don't have a problem with the human body. I like the ladies. I don't have a problem with the human body. I happen to have a wife. She's got a body. Last time I checked, I really have no problem with it whatsoever, or mine. I didn't ask Janet Jackson to expose herself to me. I didn't. That's the real problem as far as I'm concerned. It's not with the body. It was interesting to me that it was a young lady who said this. And I think, I imagine, in my mind, although I might be wrong, I imagine that she probably considered herself an enlightened feminist type. has no problem with what amounts to, in my mind, at least according to the accounts I read, a sexual assault being simulated on stage. If you walked up to a woman and tore off the front of her blouse, under any other circumstances, it would be considered a sexual assault. If you exposed her in that way. Janet Jackson says against her will, she didn't plan on it. It would be considered a sexual assault. In what way is simulating a sexual assault somehow now something we should accept because we're enlightened, because we have found new feminist sensibilities? I'll repeat what I said before in the previous hour and the moments left to us here. Feel free to complain. Feel free to complain to whoever you think will do the most good. That's fine. That is your privilege, your right, and in many cases your duty as a citizen of this country. But remember, what you saw last night was just kind of an everyday occurrence of what's going on in your heart every day. I know some of you don't think it is. You can live in denial if you want to, just as Justin Timberlake and Janet Jackson live in denial that they had planned this thing all along. Oh, it was all an accident. We didn't mean it, which is what a lot of Christians say when they think or contemplate the very kind of things that we saw in the Super Bowl party. Oh, I didn't mean it. I slipped up. That really wasn't a sin. Yes, it was, just as much as Justin and Janet. Jesus had to die for them. He had to die for you just as well. You just as much. We've got a minute left here. I want to welcome a new local sponsor to Issues Etc. It's Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights, Illinois. The pastor there is Pastor Randy Emmons. They're located at 5600 Old Collinsville Road in Fairview Heights, Illinois. You can contact them if you'd like to, not only to thank them for sponsoring Issues Etc., but also to find out more about them. Their number, 618-632-6906, 618-632-6906, or you can visit them on their website, BethanyLCMS.org, BethanyLCMS.org. And if you'd like to know how your church can become an underwriter of Issues Etc. during both the weekday KFUO edition of Issues Etc. and the Sunday night broadcast locally on 91.5 FM here, visit our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. Click on the Sponsoring Congregations section. Or give us a call at 1-800-844-0524, 1-800-844-0524. Tomorrow on the program, Christian Higher Education with Dr. Pat Ferry. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.